I mean, we still live here.
Jesus, guys, come on. I mean,
you want our spoons?
We're using them.
Welcome to Worldcasting, where we discuss real, made-up things. I'm your host, Tyler, and today you'll be joining me as we have a discussion on the core races of fantasy fiction. We'll be discussing who they are, where they come from, and how and why we use them. As well, we'll discuss ways we've seen them used and subverted, and sometimes how they can be used as an anchor to show more unique things in your setting. Today joining me are Anna, Chris, Imakane, and Inky, if you'd be so kind as to introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Anna. I am the art chair deputy for the World Building Magazine, and I draw stuff.
I'm Chris, and I still work at the nonprofit teaching world building and D&D to children.
Hello, hello. I am Imakane, also known as Iyanara Natividad. I am the editorial chair here at World Building Magazine. I'm also a freelance writer and editor.
Hello, I'm Inky. I'm one of the layout artists and illustrators here at World Building Magazine. And yeah, I also draw stuff.
Well, I'm happy to have all of you here, even if it is pronounced Iyanara.
Excuse you?
The controversy over your name isn't just your username now. It has gone into the real space. So today we will discuss a few things about the different core races. And for everyone, as a quick refresher, we'll cover that when I say core races in fantasy fiction, I mostly mean elves, dwarves, orcs, and halflings. The main races you kind of always see, halflings being hobbits from Lord of the Rings. And the different forms that they can take. There's usually very little variance in the core idea spread across most fantasy fiction, whether that's D&D or Lord of the Rings or some novel you just happen to find at Barnes & Noble that just caught your fancy. So there's this idea of these tropes put forward by Tolkien, and I think that they have been represented quite continuously over time. To get us started off, what are some ways that you guys have seen them that you've enjoyed them, where they're either totally different or in a new face, essentially?
I mean, I'm trying to think of kind of popular examples that either subverted expectations or just handled it really well. Because I've been raving about this the series for probably like five or so episodes now, I thought of the elves in The Witcher, how they're divided in a sense. There are two different kinds of elves, essentially. Ones that are native to that world, or rather, they live in that world for the most part. And then another type of elves are essentially space elves. And I think the distinction between the two, Sapkowski does well to kind of pull that distinction and make something of that distinction in the narrative. For those of you who don't know, it's like essentially the space elves kind of help out or are involved in the end of the world for some cases. That's like the quickest way I can think of it. So then, kind of in contrast to that, the elves that live in the world have to deal with pretty much in the world things. They're not nearly as involved in this larger stuff, but they have to deal with racism and rebellions, and it kind of puts it to head the differences that these two members of the same race, as we call them, have to deal with just because of their geographical location and how they developed as essentially two divergent cultures.
I also like that, and what came to my mind immediately was Dragon Age, which took a lot of reference or inspiration from The Witcher. They have two distinct types of elves, city elves and the Dalish, who are still connected to their natural environment. And it's interesting. I just especially love city elves because they're so recognizable. Like, we know that kind of suffering and being at the very like dirt bottom, most of us, but they're just really real and human, but they're not. And they have this tense relationship with their counterparts, the Dalish, who are proud and are kind of look at city elves like that you've let this happen to you. And it's a really interesting juxtaposition that I enjoy in those games.
I really do like that dichotomy they have. And especially the way that you can flip it on your head, where it's like, from one angle, yeah, the city elves kind of give in to the humans and let this happen to them. But on the other hand, when you look at like the history aspect of what they did for Elvish history and Dragon Age, it's like Tevinter came in there and beat the crap out of them and essentially forced them into this. So the Dalish are the ones who hid and ran away from the fighting. So they're no better. They're, if anything, they're worse. So you get to keep your traditions, but that's because you were a coward. And it adds this whole nice dichotomy from normal elves who are like proud and stoic beings from the beginning of time and kind of turns it on its head a little bit.
Yeah, you stole my idea that, or my example that came up for me as well. So the only other one, I don't even know if this super applies because it's not the entire race, because in Forgotten Realms, dwarves are pretty much the standard dwarf that you would see in all fantasy. But as a particular example of it, R.A. Salvatore has a character, Pikael Boldershoulder, who is a druid dwarf who has green hair and green beards, and he's like very whimsical and mystical, and he like hangs out with animals and uses a cooking pot as a helmet, and he, I don't know if he just has like a speech impediment or something for the character, but he doesn't talk like a normal character. He like grunts and has different smaller words that he uses and things like that, but it's just a very stark contrast to how dwarves are normally portrayed, and it was interesting and it stood out.
I am currently trying to remember a series of books, I believe, where it was, I think the first, I really don't remember the name or the author, because it's been quite a while. My sister had the books, so but it was, first of all, I think the first time I really read anything that was literally, I think the first book was basically just about dwarves and their society and how they live, and then other races getting in the story, but that was really later on. So you had the dwarves and the different cities as a focal point, and gosh, I really don't remember what that was. And I think at some point they find basically dark elves who live also in the mountains and are cursed, I believe, if I remember correctly. And they also were some sort of outcast and kind of like demons, but also not, and assumed to be evil, but not quite, if I remember correctly again. Yeah, but I think that was really cool because I don't remember having any human character in those books. So yeah, I really like that you had the focal point on the dwarves and elves.
I also thought of, they changed it in Pathfinder 2nd Edition lore, and so I'm not necessarily advocating this story as like cool or whatever, but in Pathfinder 1st Edition, elven lore was that they were aliens, they came to the planet via portals and whatnot, but in particular, dark elves essentially had a biological link to evil, and so if you were a normal elf and did an act suitably evil or atrocious, like genocide or, you know, something grand evil scheme, you could literally transform into a dark elf on the spot because of how dark the deed that you just did was.
I'm surprised because of how unwoke that is and how woke Paizo is.
Well, that's why they changed it when they went to second edition.
Yeah, it's that kind of, while Dino was doing his intro, I kept thinking if we should mention how we're going to refer to it as races, just because that's kind of how it's been known in the tabletop scene and the fantasy scene and whatnot. It's been perpetuated for that. Though technically, there's a lot of debate as to whether it is the correct or even appropriate usage of that term. But for our cases, we're just using it because it's easier and recognizable for the time being.
Apparently the term is woke or non-woke, according to Dino and Chris.
No. I mean, the specific delineation would be elf is a different race than dwarf, but like wood elf and high elf, those are ethnicities. And so that'd be the breakdown.
Yeah, it kind of just reflects on how race is used in the real world. But I always think of it as technically they're all humanoid species, is how I've kind of figured out how to justify using that term. And similar to how there are different people that belong to different races. So technically, some would say just really just ethnicities. That's why that term has been kind of perpetuated and kept going on. Not to mention it's probably easier on typeset to write races rather than ethnicities, but I'm not defending anyone for doing that way.
It's and you're right, it is good to clarify because it is this this topic point that people do like to discuss a lot, and I've seen it talked about a few times myself, and I feel like it is all right to kind of move forward talking about it as core races, as that's the genuinely accepted and reflected form for this discussion, as it was, I suppose. So we got a little off topic, so we'll rally back to this. And with the concept in mind of how we like to see things in different approaches, I would like to bring forward the first of the core races we'll discuss, the elves, who tend to be the most popular and most widely used, in my opinion. I mean, everyone tends to have some. And I myself have plenty of elves and dwarves and orcs and hobbitses. And I feel like elves are probably the key one you'll find the most. I mean, in Magic the Gathering, they're definitely the one you see the most. And that we all know that's a great example of different usage of core races, as every set has different versions of them. So what do you guys think? What are some things about elves that you see commonly used that aren't just the base Tolkien set?
I love me some knife ears.
Knife ears.
But I think the thing I really appreciated are one of the things I appreciate about elves is that they, along of course with the core races, they're very distinct usually in how they appear. Yet simultaneously, they're also one of the more malleable ones as far as they appear. I think about like there's like D&D elves that look pretty humanoid, but they have the standard fair and slender with pointy ears, similar to Tolkien elves, if I'm correct. And then I think of if anyone's played Divinity Original Sin, I think about those elves, and they look different from D&D elves. They are tall and lanky and have weird neck proportions, but they still share kind of that same kind of foreign lit and graceful and kind of a sharp looking features. And I could just tell they're elves. Because I do think it's easy for these different races to come off as a reskinned or slightly altered humans, more so than not. Technically, elves are probably closer to that than anything else. But I like how they can be distinct while maintaining certain kind of key characteristics.
So Bright was not a good movie, but I really enjoyed the elves. They still had that kind of ethereal feeling that you're used to with most, like any elf, D&D, Faerun, Tolkien. Fair, beautiful, but they have like, they all tend to have these clear eyes, pointy teeth, which I love on any kind of a race. So like definitely things that you're like, oh, that's an elf. Oh, that is not normal for an elf, and it makes it fun.
I think what I personally like about elves, or what I see more often than in other races, is that they actually have a sense of, I don't know quite how to call it, I guess, culture. Like, you have literature, music, or at least this is kind of what comes to my mind, that they have a very kind of artistic or fine arts approach. What if you just take the general idea of dwarves or orcs, and don't have a slight twist on them, which you usually don't really get. So yeah, I think this is something that I personally find more interesting generally in races, just how their culture works. And because there are so many also different types of elves that are more or less acknowledged, or that a lot of people use, like wood elves, high elves, for example, dark elves too. I don't know, all those kind of things. You get more of a sense like that there's not just one type of elf, but there is more to it, and there's a culture, and they also have opinion on each other.
Yeah, I really like that Inky brought up the culture, because I completely missed that. That is another thing I appreciate, and thanks for bringing that up. I do want to kind of contribute to that point. There's that kind of the old adage that the old-lived elves or the long-lived elves, and it's the way near or mortality, I think, in these works that often use elves as a fantasy race, that factor that they are often hundreds of years old, or they are meant to live hundreds of years old, and the dynamic that happens with a life that's meant to be lived that long is what happens when you have that much time. Not only with how they perceive time and how they act compared to shorter-lived races, which I think contributes to that kind of spending a lot of time in the arts and the culture, because they just have time on their hands, but also how their interactions with other cultures that don't nearly live as long tend to be kind of stilted because of that that discrepancies in their life expectations.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think, so when I was younger, and first getting into fantasy, all the elves were kind of like the Tolkien style, right? Even in Forgotten Realms, it was all, you know, Elrond, whereas essentially elves are just long-lived feudal societies that just happen to be in the forest instead of everywhere else. And that's just where they lived. But otherwise, they basically were like normal people. They had fancy-ass castles, a lot of art, and they had balls and all this other stuff. Whereas at least it seems like in settings a lot more recently, there has been a bigger trend to move towards the more like wild elves, where they're like tribal and they've got interesting tattoos. They run around in the forest and they don't have a huge society. It's more like Dalish style, if we're using the Dragon Age example again. And then Faerun, you know, they added their own wood elves and wild elves and different things to sort of change up the thing. And for my take anyway, I like that style of elves much more than the weird just high society but in a forest.
I think people were just getting tired of really snobby, probably racist elves, like that stereotype. The elves get a lot of hate for being just that, so I can see why people who like elves for like the other facets but don't want them to get stuck as racist snobby bastards would want to kind of diverge from that approach to them.
But I like the idea of like a beautiful sylvan court in the middle of a forest with high society forest elves.
I do too, but I want it to... Okay, so for me, I enjoy the lore behind elves where they're typically associated with fae. And so like if there was a high court in the deep dark forest, I would want it to reflect sort of the chaotic nature of the fae. And I just would want it to stand out as weird and mystical and not just, hey, we're going to have 12 lords sit around a council and talk about what to do about the Dark Lord, just like humans would. And everything is completely normal.
Yeah, that's fair. Another thing, too, about the culture bit with elves is this, I don't know if I could call it a trope, but maybe it is, Elven ruins, elven artifacts. It's always this coming back to how ancient and beautiful and just special that elven culture is to other races. One of my favorite in Faerun specifically is Mythdranor. Yeah. And just there's so much history and culture just in this one location, and people going back like thousands of years later into this place that's like tainted and spooky, and but they want to see like the elvish ruins. And it's a big facet in a lot of even like Paizo with the Pathfinder Society, is there's a lot of quests that are go to the elven ruins, find an elvish artifact.
I do love the exploration of something that's literally ancient, but simultaneously I want one work that says go to these elven ruins, and then the adventuring party goes there and people are living in the ruins, because to the elves they're not really they're so long lived that's all, yeah, this is our home.
I mean, we still live here.
Jesus, guys, come on. I mean,
you want our spoons?
We're using them.
Well, the point though is that I think, or for a large part at least in fantasy fiction, elves are the only ones who are allowed to have like pretty things and sophisticated things and all those stuff. And I mean, in Tolkien, actually, the dwarves also have a very rich culture, but somehow it doesn't really translate into the things in between to now. Yeah, so I think it's also like you're allowed to have those things because these are the pretty elves, and I don't know, it just has something to it that can get kind of old, and I wish that it would be used for other races too. And yeah.
No, I definitely agree. It does seem sometimes in some fantasy works that the elves are the only ones allowed to have pretty old things. Like it's their sole property. They're the only ancient empires that are allowed to exist are fallen elf ones, or the humans who blew themselves up. So as a point, we've just kind of discussed a little bit about elves, and it kind of brings home the meat of like they're variable, they're iconic, and they're this like beauty and aesthetic that is instantly noticeable. And I think that kind of encapsulate what the elves are, and that all you can trace all those back to Tolkien's elves, I think, pretty easily. And there's a lot that elves can do for your setting. We've kind of discussed a little bit about the roles they can play, and using them to expand upon this either mystical or so you can kind of use them to accentuate the background of your lore quite a bit, especially when it comes to showing the more mystical and wild sides of your world. And they will always have a foil. In Dragon Age, it's humans. In Lord of the Rings or Warhammer, it's like dwarves. Sometimes in Lord of the Rings, it's orcs. So you have this, they always have this other side to them that is one of the other, what tends to be the core races. Though in your setting, it can, of course, be anything. So I think from here, we'll just kind of quickly move on to dwarves. The dwarfs, those who are of the mountain and mine, they dig deep roads and make great works, build great mansions and fortresses, and tend to fade away before the start of your story.
Ale.
And of course, ale and salted pork.
I love dwarves. What do you like about dwarves?
Everything. I also thoroughly enjoy Dragon Age dwarves. And I like that the levels, the hierarchy that they have in their culture, it, like specifically in Dragon Age, and how it's so important that you stay in your lane, even if you are at the very bottom. You just, that's your lot in life, and you make the best of it. You don't question it. And it's very reminiscent of being like just chiseled in stone. These are the rules. And it's just, they have such a nice, wonderful, earthy flavor.
They do definitely take that, like, the earthy tone. and they play with it so well, with like the stone and just how much they have an appreciation for the rock and such, and the spirits within it.
If you guys have listened to the Evil Empires podcast, you'll know I'm a fan of taking the darker side of societies. And so one of the other parts of Dragon Age Doors I like is that there was such an emphasis on like the backstabbing, ruthless political nature of their society. And then another, because like the stereotype with dwarves is they're very industrious peoples. And so in the past, I've liked to use the idea that they're kind of like a pseudo communist culture, similar to in Dragon Age, where like this is your lane, stay in it. So just like different ways to explore themes that are typically associated with them, but not in the way that they are associated with the dwarves.
I do love my dwarven smiths. I love dwarven items. Because if it's something fancy and something awesome and something technologically advanced, I personally probably attribute that more to dwarves than anyone else. And that connects to kind of their... The tropes and the stereotypes that they are good with metalwork, with smithing. It's slightly rooted. I'm pretty sure it's rooted in some mythology. I just can't think of what exactly right now. But I do find myself kind of relying on that aspect. And of course, them being very industrious. Making dwarven market systems and market networks is within the realm of kind of what to expect, at least for myself.
I mean, just go for fairy tales, I guess. I mean, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs basically has the very hardworking mining dwarfs. So there's that. but what I personally like, I mean, I generally like the more of the culture aspects. So with the dwarves, I actually really, really like the Tolkien dwarves, and especially Gimli. I don't know, it's just a character that just really grew onto me since childhood. So maybe there's that too. But also if you just go for the dwarves in The Hobbit, just how proud they also are and what rich culture they have. And also just thinking about, for example, jewelry or something, like they can produce very pretty things. It's just not that there's an emphasis on that.
Yeah, I mean, typically, right, it's baked as, so the elves get the pretty things because they live in the forest, relatively safe, and they're long lived and all that that we talked about. But dwarves similarly typically live longer than humans in most fantasy settings, and they do have pretty things like you're saying, but they live underground, and underground is like all the dark evil things are coming up, goblins, orcs, dark elves, all these things are constantly threatening the dwarves. So while they have the capabilities of doing beautiful things with their stonework and metalwork, they have to be more practical because they are peoples that are constantly beset by evil. And in a way, they are the guardians of the surface world. So like when Dino is referencing that, you know, the only ruins on the surface we ever see are ancient elven ruins or humans that blew themselves up. We run into a lot of dwarven ruins too, but they're only when we go underground and they were destroyed by evil dark forces typically. So it's just an interesting dynamic of understanding why typically this culture doesn't have beauty represented in the fantasy genre as opposed to another one that does.
It's a good point, because a lot of like the physical like in video games, dwarves, when you get to see like the art direction and the way that people concept what items will look like. They're usually functional, geometric, not a lot of room for, you know, like an elven, like it's very airy, it's silver, it's elegant but fragile. It's like, no, these are like, I'm going to wear this bracelet and it could get smashed with 200 pounds and it's going to be fine. It's going to protect my hand.
Yeah, but I think it's just also the notion that if something is practical, it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be ugly. And just going by, I guess, dwarven stereotypes, I mean, they are masters of their craft. They are really, really, really good smiths and blacksmiths and things like that. And if you have a culture that surrounds itself with melting and working with metal, I think that it's gonna be maybe more practical and less delicate, but it doesn't mean that it has to be, or that it can't have a certain beauty to it.
No, I definitely agree that, you know, just because something is practical and well built doesn't mean that it can't be this beautiful thing. It did get mentioned that the idea of like having a bracelet that could withstand like force, like it's not just a bracelet, it's a vambracer. It's meant to protect me, but it looks beautiful as well because the person who made it is a master craftsman and I'm honored to have this. And you also see a lot about honor and respect, and you tend to see a lot about pride when it comes to dwarves. And that kind of seems pretty setting agnostic. You do tend to see that in just about all of them when a dwarf appears, when they are given the time of day to have characterization, I should say.
Yeah, and I'll also point out too, oftentimes these representations of the different groups, their purpose isn't expressly to be all-encompassing. Like, I'm sure dwarven things have utility that are also beautiful. Likewise, I'm sure elves make very elegant things that are very functional at the same time. But the point is to represent them in a way that enhances and shows the reader, the player, the person experiencing your world, whatever, the dichotomy, and emphasizes what it means to that culture, right? You want to highlight the parts of it that are important, and not necessarily saying the other parts don't exist, but because you're putting so much emphasis on the things that are relevant to either your story or setting, or to get a certain feel across or something like that, that it's going to seem like these other things don't exist when, yeah, realistically, elves make functional stuff all the time. Dwarves, I'm sure, put like fancy little runes and designs on all their stuff too. But it's not relevant for the purposes of putting off the air that you want or the feeling that you want from this race.
I just think it could give the races more depth, I think. And just not necessarily to put your work forward, but just so you always try to avoid, or like the planet of hats or the race of hats is a thing and can be useful if it's just for, let's say, one short setting or something, but if you want to build or have the races as a more reoccurring thing, and that you can examine it in more depth, then I think just to get a wider approach on the culture and on their sentiments and things like that. And for example, the with dwarves, that they are expert craftsmen. I think that would reflect in their culture as well. And maybe it's not very wide known or something like that, but for example, maybe it's a very esteemed rarity to have I don't know, a form mosaic or something like that, and find that on a marketplace or things like that. I think this would just give a bit, or give you a more layered concept, and also differentiate yourself from those more stereotypic dwarves in this case.
I think to follow up with what Inky is saying and what Dinah was saying, the bit about dwarves being really proud, but also like esteemed craftsmen, is also showcased in a lot of weaponry. So real world, we have the Ulfbert swords that are these like beautiful Viking blades that have a name literally stamped into them. And you can be like, oh yeah, that's an Ulfbert sword. And with dwarves, there's several books and an entire adventure path with the Tales of the Abyss, I think it was. I could be wrong, but you find finding like a dwarven swordsmith, and you're like, oh yeah, that's so and so, and like you could recognize just from the quality of the blade and also like maybe a little mark or something. And I think you find his tomb in one of those adventures, I don't remember, but the point being that the dwarves pride themselves in what they do as a stereotype. I think most people would pride themselves, but it's more like an honorific, yeah, you got to master swordsmith and now you can stamp your name on these swords and people will want to get that sword. Whereas with an elf, you could be like the longest lived, most amazing wizard, and you'll make a wand and it'll just be like, oh yeah, that's a great wand. What was that guy's name again?
And that does bring an interesting point into it, in the notoriety aspect of it and the fame aspect, and how sometimes you'll see with dwarven cultures, they'll have a bit about fame. Dragon Age, great example, has the paragons, dwarves who have done something so great for society that they're going to be remembered and worshipped for the rest of time. And on the reverse end, you kind of mentioned like the connections between races and how they kind of do similar things. And this made me think of a similar but different point in how you can have these core races, and yes, everyone has them and they all use them, and it's hard to use them in different ways that don't make them feel weird. It's awful. But what you can do to stand out with them is make your races interact, make them actually talk. In Lord of the Rings, the dwarves and the elves, I think in the lore, talk once. No, like three or four times. You have Thranduil betraying them, and then you have Thranduil demanding from them, and then you have when the elves try to get into Moria and failed, and then Thingol gets the dwarves to make him a Silmaril necklace. So I think that's four times. And I'm sure there's more, but the point is, like, it's very, very little that these people interact. Warhammer Fantasy Battle has a great thing between elves and dwarves. They have the War of the Beard, where dwarven custom and honor and pride is wounded by elves who shave a dwarven king's beard because they think that that's the proper form. They're tricked into it. And it starts a literal, like, thousand-year war that the blood debt still isn't paid to this day, thousands of years later. And it's just little things that tie them together that make them feel unique to your setting, and that's kind of what they're there for. They're there to feel unique to you and to what you've made, but yet grounded enough to make people understand and kind of like latch on to them and go, oh well, I've seen elves before, I know that they're tall and they're beautiful and they have pointed ears, and that's kind of, you know, the basics. And then from there you can go, well, there's a dichotomy. There are the ones who live in the city, and there's one who lives in the forest, and they're different for these reasons, and their cultures are different like this. And that's kind of how to process it, I think, and in at least my respect and how I do it, is take what is known and then work your own things into it. And the core races are a perfect example of how to do that.
Similar with the interacting point that you made, this is more for fiction writing, I suppose. But those differences that we were talking about, whether it's the stereotype or that they can do more than that, I think it's really useful. And I enjoy it in books when you're writing from a certain character's perspective. So say it's the human who's interacting with the dwarven craftsman, and he just notices all the stereotypical stuff. And so your reader is like, oh, these dwarves are like totally normal in this world, blah, blah, blah. They're just very utilitarian and stuff like that. And then later on, you have got a dwarven character, and he's just abounding about the beauty and intricacy of this device, and how if you just watch it when it's working, it does these great geometric patterns, and all this stuff is so aesthetically pleasing and functional, and da da da. And it can emphasize that your background is affecting your view of the world, and actually your world is much more detailed than that, and you can show all the nuances of the society, but then just remember the limitations of the character's perspective that you're writing from, and it can make a really interesting effect for the reader as they move through.
Jumping off of that, I think what also would be really interesting is to have the main character from the start being one of the races, and then how they view, for example, humans, because I think this group isn't done so often. And I think it's hilarious just to think about how a dwarf would think about human culture, or how a elf or an orc would think about human culture, and just also how it is ingrained. And I mean, these are things that you usually grow up with. And if you, I mean, we are, in most cases, I believe, a human who read it or play it or whatever. So I think it would be an interesting experience just from that.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to see a book from a main character's perspective as one of the different races having to look in on human culture. That'd kind of be a change for it. Anyways, so we'll continue on, and we only have two more left, and we're already running a little high, so we'll quickly discuss the little folks. Hobbits, halflings, gnomes, and how they're all kind of the same, even though D&D tells us they're different, and how hobbits is not an acceptable term to use because it's copyrighted by the Tolkien estate, but in your own private setting of your own house, you can use the term hobbits, and no one can really stop you, but besides the point.
Cease and desist.
Tell us how you really feel.
Hobbits are interesting. No, I was just thinking, like, there's so many different interpretations of what they look like, but the furry feet persists.
I was going to say just, that's because that's like the only thing he really described about them, other than that they're short.
I've seen a little bit of variance in appearance, but other than that, I mean, you guys, I'm sure, have some examples, but I can't actually think of very many settings where like the half folk or the short folk or whatever you'd like to generally call them, that they've been very unique. Like, they're always somewhat mischievous, generally they're lucky, and they're joke character adjacent typically. Like, I never see them very serious or unique or anything.
I was going to mostly state that a lot of their appearance change, the variance in it, I find that it actually comes from Lord of the Rings itself. Like, you have actual art, you have calendar art, you have all these different things from back in the 50s and 60s. And it depicts them one way. And then as you get closer to the 70s and 80s, it depicts them a different way. You have the cartoon movie version where they're like these huge headed, like, creatures that are like 2 feet tall. And then you move on, you have the 90s and the Peter Jackson movies at the turn of the millennium, and they're pretty much children sized people and with big hairy feet. And then moving in to the 2000s, you have all these different perspectives on them, like gnomes and halflings and Pathfinder. One's like a small person with a little bit of a big head, and the other one's like this gremlin beast from beyond the pale with a huge head and eyes and seeks to gain color and can turn pale if it's not entertained long enough, because it's essentially a kender, but, you know, all but name. And then you have kender, which are, I'm sorry, but kender are these creatures from D&D back in the Dragonlance setting from the 80s. They exist to steal from the party, to annoy everyone, and to take plot items and lose them. And if you play a kender in the modern day age and you insist on it, you're a bad person. I don't care.
You're a bad person.
Yeah, similar to the Pathfinder gnomes, it just annoys me when people are like, I'm just so silly and I can just mess up your game all the time. And in Pathfinder, they're gnomes kind of along the lines of elves, except not in morality sense. They literally go insane if they're bored too long. And I don't know, that just annoys me.
Yep.
When I first read Lord of the Rings, I was like 13. And I was given the huge like trilogy book in just one book. So it could have killed a man. But the art was by one of my favorite, to this day, my favorite illustrators, Donato Giancola. I never remember how to say it. But like, I just think the way that he illustrates, because he's like super, he loves Lord of the Rings and Middle Earth and all of those things. And so he illustrates the characters and you can just see them brought to like this really beautiful, brought to life, that are just like really realistic, not cartoonish. Like they've, hobbits and gnomes have kind of, like you were saying with Pathfinder, have gotten way cartoony and wacky, but these illustrations and just like the path that Frodo has to take are just really grounding and gritty and real, which I appreciate because I prefer it. Also, so the cover that I had, Frodo's is really, really a good looking chap.
Yeah, Donato Giancola is a phenomenal artist. Definitely recommend checking out some of his work. And it is this interesting shift that they've taken. And they all do, as Chris kind of mentioned, have this, the same thing kind of going for them. Like, they're a little bit magical, a little bit resilient to darkness. They're lucky and they're plucky. And honestly, they're either a joke, an audience advocate, or ignorable. Like Samwise Gamgee.
I'm going to advocate, don't make joke things in your setting. You don't want your setting to be taken as a joke, so make it like realistic or serious. Like, you can have comedy in it, but don't make something that's just there as a punchline.
Yeah, then it's just joke characters in general. Like, if that's their only single facet and one-dimensional, is really terrible. But don't then use it to excuse, I don't even know how to phrase this, but the example being in Pathfinder, in their world Galarian, halflings are kept as slaves in certain countries because, like, one, they're small and they're easy to boss around, but two, because of their chipper and like happy outlook, they can withstand the horrors of being a slave really well.
God, Path of Galarian, why?
So it could be interesting, but I think in this instance, it's just very much like, oh, that makes me cringe a lot.
The thing when we're kind of getting off topic, but I'm thinking about the joke character comment or something that's jokey. I think it's fine to start it off as like that, because I feel as though there's a lot of people that don't know what exactly they want. And sometimes a joke is a weird place to get an idea from. It's continuously running with the joke as a one-dimensional thing, as had been mentioned. However, when something starts like that, it's possible to explore it and give depth as you realize what direction you want to go with it.
I think understanding the direction you want to push something can also help a lot. And using a joke is easy, but it's the easy way out. So it's not the, there are other ways that are easy, like like just using hats, which, you know, we advocate not to, but sometimes if someone has to be the paragon example of what their people are, the noble orc, the proud dwarf, the haughty elf, that's okay to use too. And then you can tune that pretty easily with just a little bit of spit and a screwdriver, and it'll come out to be something different. Heck, take Drista Ordon, the most famous dark elf, and how that could be so weird if it was the exact opposite end of him being an evil dark elf. But he is he's the typical example of a dark elf flipped. So even he is just an easy fix. And I love Drist.
Hashtag Chosen of Loth.
Or just add more characters of that race and show the variety you can have with those.
So from here, I think, especially talking about the culture of hats and showing the archetypical paragon, we'll show the race that never really gets justice unless it feels forced. And that's orcs. And in this section, you could also consider orcs, goblins, and trolls to kind of be the same, because they usually are always clustered together. They're always something off about them. They're always totally different, like foils almost to humanity and to elves. They generally serve dark powers, or they just have a brutal culture, and they tend to be the more monstrous, less civilized side. The noble savage usually gets used as a trope with the orcs, that they're good people, but they're, you know, they don't have roads.
Just uncivilized.
There's going to be unpopular opinions in this section.
For the horde.
there's the first one.
That's an example of just like a slightly different take on orcs, right? Because in Azeroth, they actually have like, it is a warrior culture, but it's not quite savage to the level that the typical orc is, where, oh, they just live in like war camps and huts and all they do is raid. Whereas in Azeroth, they've got their whole society set up. They've got rulers, they have alliances, they have political intrigue. So it's a little more advanced, even if it is still very much a warrior culture.
Aren't they technically like conquerors from space, from like a different world? In
orcs, yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of giving you a different spin, I suppose. Explains also how they managed to get their civilization more up and running compared to what we typically see of orc cultures.
Yeah.
Somehow I always have to think about the Klingons from Star Trek, because it's a similar nature, I guess. But I think with a slightly Planet of the Hats approach, but it's more bearable than what a lot of orcs get, I suppose. So you could go in that direction.
I definitely will agree that Klingons are kind of space orcs with funny hats, like literally those headpieces. They're cool, but that's what sets them out. I guess with orcs, that you kind of have this, like, they're the archetypical bad guy. I mean, even in Warhammer Fantasy Battle, which is supposed to be the Empire of Man versus the forces of chaos from the wastes, the orcs are kind of the ones in everything. Like, they did this huge event with their tabletop game where you reported in, it was called the Storm of Chaos, and you reported in every, like, week or so with what tables were winning in what fashion. And out of nowhere, the orcs won. Like, they won the Storm of Chaos, this huge event that involved every faction, and legitimately they won, and they put it in a book that out of nowhere in the final big battle, you have Empire and the Chaos, which are ramping up to be one of the winners, the orcs just come in and win it, and they just beat both of them and then leave. And they're always kind of there as the battle mad warriors, and they do fill a nice role in your setting. They can fill the warrior people or the raider people, especially when it comes to goblins, who tend to be less civilized, despite the great Warcraft flip on its head where they're mad inventors and scientists. But you tend to have goblins as raiders who are incredibly uncivilized, like Stone Age level. And then you have trolls who tend to have no form of society, who tend to be more monstrous and live in like packs, essentially, and are only prodded when other races do so. And then orcs tend to be more organized. I know even for my own setting, I took the difference. Goblins and orcs are kind of the same. And the difference between a goblin and an orc is that an orc is organized.
Well, I was just thinking about how Warcraft did such a good job making these, like, quote unquote, monstrous, I guess in D&D terms, monstrous humanoids with their own distinct societies, and then coming together to make a faction where they're all trying to benefit from one another. And it's just really good. But it's still like you have the pretty races on one side and then the ugly races on the other side, the ugly, quote unquote. So there is still this idea that if you're not perfect and pretty, that there's either something wrong, or this stereotype that of being evil or not smart. So a lot of other orcs tend to be represented as intelligent, just like in a fierce battle kind of way. Goblins tend to be like just dumb, bite at your ankles, do what they're told sorts.
And swarm.
So it's nice sometimes to challenge those, but it's always going to be a difficult thing to do, because we're still, like we were talking about in the Tolkien episode, it's just now in this time of our lives that people are understanding, oh, that's not a good way of representing an entire people's. And so they're introducing in adventure paths and in books the other side of the coin and fleshing out what used to be a one-dimensional guy you could just beat up and get experience from.
Yeah, there's evil by DNA, basically, that a lot, up to this point, just has been. And I mean, if we look just from where orcs especially come, when you look at mythology and stuff like this, I mean, yeah, they were the evil guys, but usually they were just one ogre or something like this in that direction that had to be overcome. It was not like a race, it was more like an obstacle. And just putting that into a race is just very difficult, because you have this evil by DNA approach. And I mean, this generally also the ugly and dumb. If you're ugly and dumb, that you're easily evil. I mean, this is also from the 18th century still, so 18th, 19th century. And we had in not necessarily fantasy, but other branches of literature that broke off. But I think fantasy, since it is very deeply rooted in mythology and all the legends and stuff like that it's harder to overcome, because it's not, in quotations, it's not human races, but something that you can look at, kind of human but not quite, and it's a monster. And there are just some very nasty implications. So I don't think that just presenting the other side of the coin is really helping much, but more to diversify the race itself. Like, there are those people, and they have this view, and they have that view, and that makes it more realistic and more well-rounded and helps much more than just, yeah, but they thought we hit them first, which just doesn't, that's basically every conflict ever.
What about they stole my wife? That's how wars are started.
Yeah, a lot of Troy, yeah. What tales old time.
But I mean, that it can just be solved by doing another side of the coin if you make them just as detailed as all your other races, right? And I went about this ad nauseum in the Evil Empires episode. Everyone's terrible. So why can't you, you know, write an entry where the orcs are like, dude, humans are freaking psycho. They're just like sending random people into our camps all the time, slaughtering everyone. We weren't even doing anything. We were fighting the other orcs because we kind of like have beef with our neighbors, but we weren't bothering them. Or like if they see them, if you're going with the ugly approach, right? They're like, oh God, human women are so gross. They're so thin. Like, look at their teeth. They're not even big. They look like baby's teeth. I don't want to, like, I'm not attracted to that at all. And then it just shows that they have more thoughts in them than, you know, I want to raid something. And that's all it really takes, is just make them realistic, full-fledged creatures, right?
Zug, zug. I think, therefore, I am.
Profound. One of the things, too, about exploring cultures, and that's basically, like, a race in these senses are all completely different, probably had a completely separate root ancestor, so not related to humans at all, but they still have a culture. And depending on where they are, like, you can have an orcs in the north and then orcs in the south, and they can be orcs, but they can also be completely different culture wise and but then there's things that can set them apart. So, like, just speaking as a human being, we're very, very tribal, and it's just a natural thing. That's how we are. And so when most of the time, when we go into world building, we're like, okay, here's a people versus another a people. And the way we basically differentiate is, here are the things that make us different. And so orcs, I don't know, maybe they eat people. That's scary. Or maybe they eat each other. That's scary. But then if you go and actually explore it in the culture, which it could still be scary. Maybe they eat certain body parts to gain power, or maybe they do like such and such. But from what's normally like a human point of view, you're like, that's the other. We would never do that. And that's what marks them as, like, an orc is uncivilized because they have these barbaric practices. So that's just the trope for orcs, though. And I don't know how much it can be pushed away from that and still feel like an orc. Because I like to hate orcs, but I also I love orcs, so... But I like it because they're mean and they're nasty.
I like to hate things for a reason. how I like to think of it. But to be fair, I understand all kind of dislike for the representation of orcs as it's kind of inherently evil, or as one-sidedly evil because of appearances and monstrous so-and-sos. I do think a lot of what plays into that is this concept of othering. I think it's a lot easier generally for a population or a group to either abhor or hate, dislike, whatever negative feelings it is, when something is distinctly different from them. And while I don't want to say it's an excuse, I think in writing, when you describe something as inherently monstrous or something that would invoke feelings of fear or terror, it becomes understandable for a reader, whether we truly believe it or intended to not, to see why they are the other, they are the enemy. And of course, that might or might not be kind of confirmed via their actions.
it would, I have not seen a setting or read a book where this is the case, but like high society orcs, posh, eating off of silver plates.
Shadowrun.
Oh no.
Shadowrun?
Okay, I need to play Shadowrun.
After in Forgotten Realms, so this is like right before the split into 4E. There was an orc warlord, Obold, who was the chosen of Groomsh. He created an entire orc country. And then after the time skip, there are instances where characters are interacting with orc diplomats who are dressed well, they speak finely, and they're representing their country trying to get trade deals and whatnot, because it's like 100 years later and that country has established itself and now they have culture.
Well, I always think of, especially with the whole raiding thing, is just looking up Vikings and Norsemen, because, I mean, they were known for being violent and things like that, but they had a completely different home culture, but they had a home culture that was not about killing each other 24/7 and raping and stealing things from other people. So just giving them this part would be at least humanizing. And I think that was also said before, just giving different, or generally, I think this is an issue with having fantasy races, that you usually only have one culture per race, which is kind of weird to me, because if we just, I mean, yeah, we have a planet of mainly human dominance, but if we just look at the human race, how very, very different we are, just from where we come from and how we were raised. And then just having one type of orc and one elves are, as we established before, is something slightly more special. So you have three types of elves and one type of dwarf and one, two, three types of halflings. It's kind of, it makes the world feel much smaller than it could be. And it kind of also limits your races in terms of just giving them extra flair. And why are we going to these elves, or why are we going or trying to talk to these orcs compared to the others, or things like that? I think there could be so much potential just by adding several cultures to them, and just also experiencing, well, these orcs from the north are actually quite agreeable and we get along with them, but why are you from the south telling me that they are completely terrible and I don't, something like that. I think this would also create very interesting tensions and misunderstandings that can also be interesting to explore.
Yeah, because I think it's useful to do that, especially if you're willing to either put in the work or take a larger setting or something like that. Because one of the problems that tends to make all these different groups the same, like all the different orcs are the same, all the different dwarves are the same, whatever, is the pantheons, actually. So like in most Dungeons and Dragons settings, there is one orc god. And so all the orcs, no matter where they are, kind of act the same because they all worship this one god. And unlike real world analogies where different cultures worship the same god and act differently, in D&D settings, the god is literally real and you can actually go talk to him. And if you're doing something wrong, he will show you by taking away your divine magic, which is a hugely important thing in any fantasy setting. And so it kind of forces all cultures to be way more homogeneous than they otherwise need to be. And so if you are willing to put in the work and make multiple orc gods, make an orc god that is only worshipped by the people in the north, an orc god that's worshipped by the people in the south, and they're different, and then it makes their cultures different. Or even changing some of the core tenets of the stereotypical gods. So like, I always have to dispend my belief a little bit whenever any novels in Forgotten Realms have the drow unite to fight some outside enemy, right? Because Loth, her like core tenet is kill each other all the time so I can find out who's the best. And I'm like, how does a society function like that at all? And so like when Inky was giving the example of comparing orcs to Vikings, how they had a different culture going home, but they had a certain persona when they went out, that's hard to accomplish with orcs because Grumsh's tenants are like kill each other all the time. And so when they go home, they're just as much of a jerk to each other as they are to people they consider others. So if you just tweak that a little bit where it's like, oh, you know, find out who's the best warrior of you by attacking other people. Now they can go home and be totally nice to their neighbors and loving and like have normal relationships and blah, blah, blah. So just, yeah, take a look at pantheons in particular for races, because that is a huge defining factor in creatures' cultures.
Yeah, that's exactly touching on what Dino had said way earlier, having the dark master, and that could be a god, it could be Sauron, it could be, you know, some powerful thing that can tell you what to do.
And you have this concept that there are going to be so many differences. And like, if even if you have these big races, doing like only orcs worship Grumsh, or does Grumsh make people worship him more orcs? And as an example, I know that doesn't happen, but it's the idea of like, is it literally the only way to worship is to be this? And you're in fantasy, so that's possible. But at the same time, if not, nothing says that orcs can't, there can't be a society of orcs on the coast that worships a sea god, or up in the north that worships the ice god and the seal god, and you know, lives up there. Nothing says they can't do that and still be orcs. And I think that people are a little afraid to branch out and make things with a bent like that.
Don't be afraid, people. It makes things more interesting. Variety is the spice of life.
I want to add to a touchy subject potentially, but just like, not just physical differences and not just talking about orcs, but say goblins. So what is the potential for them getting to a quote unquote civilized state if they're just like not evolved enough, like their brains ain't big enough to adopt different, like things that are different. So different races, I have a house full of cats. They just want to eat and sleep. They don't want to make a society. maybe they do. I just don't know it yet. But what is the potential for using goblins that are just, that's where they're at right now, just like biting your ankles and throwing poop a la Pathfinder? What is their potential? Or are they just stuck there forever?
I think that's useful if in your storytelling medium, whether it's your campaign setting, your novel, whatever, if you have a big time scale, right? So like the Forgotten Realms example with the Orc Nation, they were all before that, the stereotypes that we've been talking about, raider culture, it wasn't doing much, just killing each other, killing other people. And every once in a while, there'd be so many of them that they had to show up on the surface and kill a bunch of people so that their population would go back down. But because they were working with such a large time scale, and then they did a time skip, they were able to show a transition of like, okay, well, their culture has evolved now, to use the words that you were using with the goblin. And so now they're in a different place and we can represent them in a different way. And so unless you're writing a story in that transition moment, you need a wider lens in which to tell those types of stories, I think.
Yeah, and you have to kind of, I think, understand where you're going with when you're starting something. You kind of have to, I think, agree with yourself that there's not going to be a difference like that, maybe, and be a little more, trying to make this sound all right. I'm not, so. The thing with it, I think, is that you have to go with it with a bent that you're going to make them equal in some regard, and that what's keeping them down could possibly be their giant mystical dark lord, some outside thing. Maybe they're just continuously hunted into extinction in the woods and they never get to advance, and time and stability would help. Or maybe they're just little monsters that eat, attack, and do nothing else. And sometimes that's all they need to be. It's I think you have to determine what's okay for with you and your audience.
So if goblins are cats, I'm going to have a noble that has a pet goblin.
Yes, please. That sounds incredible. Also terrible, but mostly incredible. This is going to be fucked up, disclaimer. But, you know, even in ancient, not even ancient, like 100 years ago, Spanish courts would keep like legit dwarves, people who have dwarfism, as essentially pets because they were considered good luck. And they would just like have them around because they're good luck. You could kiss their feet for extra good luck. The point being, people keep pets and it's really fucked up when it's another person.
You mean slavery is bad? No, I'm not gonna joke about that, but no, that's terrible. That's awful. I think that also goes back again to because they look different, they seem different, they are treated differently. So I guess my point is, don't judge a book by its cover, guys. And while an outward kind of for people to have kind of ideas or approaches or kind of these preconceptions about another group based on appearance, is I think that's something that we're going to do no matter what. We can be mindful of it. But because we are limited by our knowledge and our perspective, when we see only kind of what's in front of us, that will color how we act. I think that's just humanity's thing in general. However, I don't think that should be an excuse to kind of let that be the end all be all of your world building. It's possible to have, and kind of to tie it back to the Joe character things, it's possible to have depth beyond initial impressions. And as writers, as world builders and creators, we just have to be more, I don't want to say mindful, because we can be mindful without actually doing it. So maybe someone else has a good way of putting it that I'm not quite encompassing in my words.
No, I think that sounds great. Another thing too that I had wanted to talk about, since we're kind of at the end after all the summaries and discussions, but the race is interacting, and like Chris used the word homogenous, and I think that sometimes that is too easy to do in writing and world building, and just being like, okay, here is X city. It's filled with these humans. That's it. But their literal neighboring person is orcs. There's not a wall in between them. So there's going to be a mixing of either the culture, or in D&D you can have half-orcs, and that might occur a lot depending on the cultures. And I really love that idea that that cultures and races are fluid and can blend with each other, and we don't always fight, just most of the time, but even so, you can have these distinct areas in between that are a mix of both cultures, and that's an important idea to keep just in the back of your mind when you're designing like borders between countries, or even areas where one particular race of creatures thrives and another is trying to live in that area as well. Maybe not their native environment.
I definitely fully agree with that. I think people tend to put places down and go, that's all that's there, and then make stuff around them that's totally different. And you have this almost like isolationism in every little pocket of the world. And I think the funniest thing is, I remember reading in a setting that there was this like merchant republic, you know, traders and merchants and such, and going out is the main thing that you do to make money as a merchant. And they're surrounded by all this, and they're all human, and they're surrounded by essentially nothing but non-humans, and no non-humans live in their nation. And they go out and trade, and you're telling me that not even other ethnicities are there? I think people tend to forget, they get lost in it, that people blend together. They believe the grass is always greener and try to find another place to live. And they try to blend in with other people and mix and make this new culture out of it.
Also, people are incredibly curious. Doesn't make sense logistically to just have one race within your trading empire, or just one ethnicity, because those who trade with you would have some settlements within your nation and stuff like that. But that's aside. Another point was more about the goblin issue, I suppose, we have before. That just came to my mind. I think it's essentially what or who is considered a person in X race's eyes. So for the goblin example, maybe one race sees them as just these neighing, annoying, I don't know, beasts that have little to no intelligence, and others can work with them and trade with them and stuff like that. So just also consider how different races view each other if you have multiple of them, and why that is so, and also maybe how they react to the view of other races on this race. And I think this, who's a person, who's considered a person, who could be a legitimate trading partner or partner in politics, stuff like that.
So I think right there we'll take a call for any last thoughts. If you guys have anything else to say on the subject of the core races and the different beings therein listed.
I have a last thought. And it is that Carnival Row is fucking incredible. And I can't believe neither of us talked about it this whole time, Dino. Carnival Row, yes, it doesn't have orcs per se. It has its own group of distinct core races, quote unquote. But it's just all the different races are very rich in their culture, distinct looking, and it's that where I was talking about the cultures intermingling, this is cultures colliding, and what happens when there's a bunch of people in a very confined space that are all different looking, different belief systems. And it's important to consider where each race, just in your own world building, and maybe to think about in other people's world building, where did that race come from? How are they treated by other races? What is their culture, and how can it change depending on where they're located?
I guess to hop on that bandwagon, what Anna started, how a race kind of is perceived and kind of how the people of that race act, their histories. There's always some justification. If you want it to handle well, there has to be justification. That could be either, we've seen different religious beliefs, gods that are real, they're kind of directing them, how histories, conflicts between within themselves and perhaps with other races have shaped their outlooks and their behaviors. There's depth to races. Making something that's just cartoonishly good or cartoonishly evil will likely end in failure or a kinder scenario or something even worse, if it's possible. But to get that depth, that if looking at other fictional works isn't enough, I think it's also good to look to our histories. While I'm not calling any specific race anything, the idea and the unfurling of how cultures develop and how outlooks affect reality is definitely ingrained in our histories, in our reality. And sometimes looking at that, reflecting on it, and figuring out how things came to be can be a great boon to anyone that wants to be mindful and perhaps very detailed and kind of giving this part of the world building enough depth that it deserves.
I think for me, it's mostly that you should first of all think about the location of the right. It is very unlikely that they are not widely spread. So if you have your dwarves in the north, then they probably have a different culture than the dwarves in the south or in the west or in the center. And they will have views on each other and on other races, and the other races will have views on them and on each of the tribes or whatever you have. So just think about giving them more dimension than that's just that one type of dwarf that exists in this world, and there's nothing else that a dwarf can basically be, or how a dwarf basically behaves, or the culture a dwarf grows up in. And go maybe beyond what is typically the culture of X race. So if you have a culture that is war driven, how do they behave at home? Is it the same or is it not the same? And all those, don't forget to actually build stuff like actual culture apart from wars and fights and things like that. And don't just push it on one singular race because they just live very long and look pretty and are in the woods or something like that.
Yeah, my final thought would just be don't make joke things just for the purpose of making jokes. Silly things is fine, but like I said before, if you want someone to take your world serious, make it serious. And it doesn't have to be boring. It just needs to like be realistic, and nothing in the world is one-dimensional. Everything is complex, incredibly so. That's why, you know, things like psychology and sociology are so difficult and almost always wrong. It's because things are way too complicated for even very, very intelligent people to understand. So never be afraid that your world is too complicated, because the real world is too complicated. So be more in-depth.
I would say that my last thoughts are just kind of a twofold thing. One, don't be afraid, but don't get lost in what you're making. We just to expand and build and make all these different things, but make sure that you can stay in control of it and that you have a handle on it. And because it can get out of hand very fast. You know, you have humans, elves, dwarves, and orcs in your setting, and then you give each of them five different variations, and now you suddenly have 25 races, and then it'll just keep on cropping up and expanding from there. So I just caught word of caution to keep a hand on it. And second of all, we talked about them a lot today in the aspect of the core races and how you can use them, but they had aspects to them that were just identifiable and that you immediately had. And it was brought up by Anna about Carnival Row. And that show does an amazing job with making world building unique and not having, you know, the core races, or does it? Because if you look at the core races as archetypes, Carnival Row kind of has them. And just on the surface, the Goatmen, the Pucks, the little bit you learn about them, they fight each other, they brutalize each other. In Puck society, you step on each other to climb up. That sounds like orcs. The Pixies are kind of like elves, and therein there's more. And the world's vibrant and beautiful, and it falls just there, just left of the core races, using them as a framework for their world. Today, I'll leave you with a quote by George R. R. Martin. "I've always preferred writing about gray characters and human characters, whether they are giants or elves or dwarves or whatever they are. They're still human, and the human heart is still in conflict with the self. Thank you.
You've been tuned into Worldcasting, an affiliate production of Worldbuilding Magazine. Have any feedback, comments, questions, or concerns? You can get in touch with us on our website, worldbuildingmagazine.com. There you can find links to our social media, or feel free to come chat with us on the Worldbuilding Magazine Discord server. Thanks for listening to Worldcasting, and until next week, keep worldbuilding.